I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Tomorrow, the U.S. and North Korea begin 3 days of meetings in Beijing. The question, has North Korea already, or will it eventually, begin reprocessing more than 8,000 spent nuclear fuel rods, which would enable Pyongyang to make, nuclear experts say, as many as 3 or 4 nuclear bombs a month. Assistant Secretary of State James Kelly will lead the U.S. delegation for the talks, which will include China as well. Joining us from Seoul, South Korea now is Doug Strzok, Northeast Asia Bureau Chief for The Washington Post. Hi, Doug.
Thank you, Bill.
Thanks, Doug. Doug, you're in Seoul, and the South Korean government is not invited to this gathering. What's the response there, and why aren't the South Koreans welcome, seemingly?
There's a great deal of disappointment in South Korea because of it. In fact, the president of this country, Roh Moo-hun, suggested that the disinvitation of his country was a source of disappointment and wounded pride. In fact, South Korea has put about 5 years of effort into trying to cultivate good relations with North Korea. And also, No was elected on a platform of trying to bring his country into a more independent state from out from under the wing of the U.S. So the fact that both Washington and Pyongyang are going ahead in these talks without them has been a great source of disappointment.
On the other hand, Doug, the negotiator for the North is not believed to be senior enough, is he, to really cut deals? Is anything going to come out of these talks?
Well, he's a familiar figure to Washington, so it's not as though he's an insignificant negotiator. But really, the only person who can cut deals in this is Kim Jong-il, the leader of North Korea. Is anything going to come out of it? Most people are hard-pressed to figure out how these talks can end up with the success that they need. That is, a whole big package in which North Korea agrees to dismantle its nuclear program, and the United States agrees to put itself on better footing with North Korea. Both of those are hard pills for their leader, respective leaders, to swallow, and it's unlikely that that much is going to come out of the talks.
Now, how did it happen, just in brief, that China got involved? The U.S., of course, has wanted China to be involved. What will China's role be?
It remains to be seen exactly how much of a role they'll play in the talks, but their main function there is to give the U.S. some cover. The U.S. has demanded that it not meet one-on-one with Pyongyang. The fact that China is hosting these talks gives them the excuse that they're not meeting one-on-one, but it's a three-way conversation.
Doug Strzok, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Doug Strzok is the Northeast Asia Bureau Chief for The Washington Post. He joined us from Seoul, South Korea.
Iraq is about to be rebuilt, and one area in dire need of help is the educational system. Creative Consultants International, an American-based company that specializes in post-conflict countries, has already won the USAID contract to handle books, desks, and teacher training in Iraq. And while the company says they've already subcontracted Iraqi exile organizations, there is concern in Iraq about the Americanization of the education process. Dick Gordon, host of NPR's The Connection, has been in Baghdad for a while. And Dick, we know that you have heard some of these fears on the part of Iraqis.
They're particularly concerned that some sort of curriculum is going to be handed to them. They're already a little bit uncomfortable about the fact that the Americans are helping them design whatever system of government will come here. The close ties between Ahmed Chalabi and General Jay Garner make them a little bit edgy simply because they've been dealing with governments handed to them all their lives. And so the educated people are saying, we really, really want to have a say in how this is done.
Ahmed Chalabi of the Iraqi Congress, who has been out of the country for a while and has returned. And tell us, though, Dick, what kind of system has been in place? What are we talking about even rebuilding?
Well, the civics course for young kids is a little bit strange. I have some translated copies of it referring to the president and leader, may God preserve him, which is a sort of honorific normally reserved for people of prophet status. I also have in front of me the new English course for Iraq, Book 8. This is senior high school level. And if I turn the page to Unit 9, I see a photograph of Saddam Hussein and a paragraph that goes like this. Some of the most important achievements of the revolution are the nationalization of natural resources, industrialization, industrialization and agrarian reform, raising the standard of living, particularly for the working classes, granting autonomy to the Kurdish people, and so on and so forth. And really, most of it is just utter pap. The English teachers, the civics teachers, the social studies teachers are saying that this really has to start from the very bottom. And while they're open to getting some kind of involvement, what they're saying is we will be involved in the process all the way along.
Before Hussein came into power, we know that the Iraqi people were voracious readers. There's a saying in the region, I'm sure you've heard it, that other countries in the region write and publish the books, the Iraqis read them. So despite their concerns and a little bit of trepidation, do you sense that they're hungry for a new education system?
They're really a little bit leery of reopening the schools, which have all been closed since the first day of the attack, without anything new. But they are eager to go back to school. The kids are eager to go back to school. The teachers are as committed as teachers I have met anywhere in the world. And it just comes down to the fact, Robin, that they will deal with what they can deal with until they get a new textbook. I've been talking with people who are involved with this in Bosnia and Herzegovina, and they're in their seventh year of still trying to fix an educational curriculum that deals with a state that has different languages and different religions, and certainly that template fits here in Iraq. So it's going to take a long time.
Right. And is there any fear that if it takes a long time and the education system doesn't approve, it will be replaced by the religious schools, as happened in other countries like Pakistan and Afghanistan?
Well, certainly one of the most awkward things they're going to have to navigate is an inclusion of the ability to allow the Shia and the Kurds to put in certain aspects of their own particular interests without necessarily going too far off the text of Iraqi nationalism, which is something that most people in this country still talk about with some pride. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be a very, very delicate thing for them to deal with.
Dick Gordon, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Dick Gordon is host of NPR's The Connection. For his daily reporter's journal, go to our website, here-now.org.
Well, WBUR's Michael Goldfarb covered the Iraq War from the north of the country. He crossed into Iraq from Iran, moving south to the city of Mosul as Iraqi forces retreated and Kurdish Peshmerga fighters advanced. After 31 days in Iraq, Michael is now back in London, from where he joins us with some observations on the immediate aftermath of regime change. And Michael, liberation in Mosul where you were, but also mixed feelings, a very complex emotion seeming to run through the people there in Mosul.
Yes, Bill, these are extremely, extremely complicated times. I mean, I think sometimes just watching as the U.S. has so slowly moved towards, you know, getting some order, getting Jay Garner in place, I think that somehow some people in the administration may have believed their own propaganda, that people would be so overjoyed. You'd have scenes like 1945 in France, rather than scenes like in 1990 in the Soviet Union, in 1991 in the Soviet Union. When a totalitarian society falls apart, the best people can feel is relief. And then immediately the anarchy breaks out. But I went, as soon as it was announced that Mosul was in coalition hands, as it were, I went and was taken to a home where a family that had been living in political exile from Saddam over in the Kurdish autonomous region came home. And I witnessed this extraordinary scene of a grandson in his 20s who hadn't seen his grandmother for several years. And they were hugging each other. And the woman was just beside herself with joy. And this is what joy sounds like. And you can hear that there's a fair amount of pain in there as well, and disbelief and relief. But at the same time that scene was being played out, and I have to assume that there were similar scenes being played out all over Mosul, in the street, the looting and the violence had already started. And downtown, for example, the central bank was being looted, and Kurdish Peshmerga fighters were trying to stop it. And within this, you know, the gunfire and the crying and who's really got the law and order authority, because frankly, Mosul is a majority Arab city, and the idea of Kurdish fighters trying to keep the peace in this way by firing you know, people, mostly Arabs inside the central bank, only built hostility. And as we know, over the last weeks, Mosul was the scene of the most violence in all of Iraq, even though there'd never actually been a fight, a battle for the city, with upwards of 30 people killed in a variety of circumstances. You know, civilians protecting property, the U.S. military killed some civilians, and it became a very messy situation.
Who's calling the shots now in Mosul? Who's in charge?
Well, when I left, this was an extremely complicated situation. The real element of civil society that is working, so far as I can tell, are the mosques, whether they're Shia mosques or Sunni mosques, Kurdish mosques, and the Kurds are Sunnis. The mosque is the only effective functioning part of civil society there. And when I went to a mosque just opposite the University of Mosul, the second day of rioting, I found the courtyard stacked up with looted goods. What they had done is they'd set up local checkpoints and roadblocks and stopped cars that were, you know, packed high with booty, removed the booty and taken it to the mosque. And, I mean, there was no rough justice. I mean, they didn't drag people into an alleyway and beat them up or, you know, drag them to the jailhouse, because there are no jailhouses working at the moment. They simply let them go. And upstairs in the mosque, I found a room that was just filled with medicine that had been looted from the local hospital. There were three doctors trying to operate a kind of local clinic, as it were. People who needed regular doses of medication, insulin, for example, could come to the mosque and get their medicines. And the people in the mosque were exceptionally upset and angry with the U.S. because, as I say, relief first and then an enormous bundle of conflicting feelings. You know, democracy didn't arrive with the troops. Freedom didn't arrive with the troops. And this is what a couple of the men upstairs in the mosque had to say about the overthrow of Saddam and the role of the United States.
No, I am not sad. I am happy. I hope maybe a best future for us doing in Iraq. We are just want to live as a free people. We want to travel. We want to build ourselves. We want to build the freedom. We want democracy. I mean, the American people not better than us.
I don't like Saddam Hussein, but I know very well that the troops, American, is not more than thieves. You are, the American, they are here not to liberate us. The American are here to steal us, steal the country, the wealth of the country, all what we have.
Michael Goldfarb, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Bill.
Michael Goldfarb is with WBUR's Inside Out documentary unit. He spoke to us from the BBC studios in London.
Just ahead, why are so many children in Harlem suffering from asthma?
And later in the program, some say he's the greatest jazz bassist since Charles Mingus. We talk to Philly's own Christian McBride.
There's more coming up here and now. Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
In Manhattan's Harlem neighborhood, one in four children has asthma, which is double the rate researchers expected to find. Nationwide, around 6% of Americans are affected by asthma, and inflammation and constriction of airways that can leave a victim gasping for breath. Now, the surprising findings in Harlem are revealed in a study by Stephen Nicholas of the Columbia University School of Public Health and the Harlem Hospital Center. Dr. Nicholas now joins us. Welcome, doctor.
Hello.
Doctor, why so much asthma in Harlem?
Well, it's a bit of a surprise to us. We knew that there was a considerable amount of asthma because Harlem Hospital has got the third highest rate of hospitalization of childhood asthmatics in the city. But in an effort to get home-based services to children, we began working in a 24-square-block area in which we screened every child under 13 years of age and found that a quarter of them had asthma. That's four times the national average. That's twice the rate that we thought we were going to find.
And asthma for a child can be very traumatic. It's hard to breathe.
Not just traumatic, but really interferes, even in mild cases, with just day-to-day functioning, sleeping, exercise, ability to concentrate, and some children actually die from asthma.
So what triggers it? And again, why so much in Harlem, do you think?
Well, there's two things you've got to think about. What causes asthma as opposed to what triggers it? And we're not sure what causes it. Presumably, you've got to have a genetic predisposition. But we know that there are many triggers for asthma in the homes of the children that we're dealing with. Most of them are poor, living in not great housing. There are things like cockroach feces. There's mites, cigarette smoke, mold, mildew. There's also a large number of diesel buses and car and truck traffic. All these things, in some children at least, can trigger their asthma, even though it may not cause it.
So multiple causes suggests no simple solution.
That's correct. And what we're trying to do is to address the obvious things that commonly trigger asthma. We're going into the homes, reducing many of these triggers. But additionally, we know that there are good treatments for these children, and many of them simply don't have the right medications, either because the diagnosis hasn't been made or because the doctor doesn't have the right information to categorize the illness.
There are asthma researchers who say that children in the developed world are more likely to get the disease because they're actually exposed to fewer germs when they're growing up.
Well, this is really kind of a new thinking and seems paradoxical to the traditional thinking, which is that maybe asthma and certain allergies are a byproduct of civilization, that we live in too clean an environment and we should all go back to the farms and be around more dust and allergens and things like that. That maybe early exposure in infancy or young early childhood to a variety of factors in the environment would help you to be able to handle those without having your lungs twitch, essentially, and have a difficult time breathing. But what the relationship of those findings is to what we're seeing and experiencing, we're not sure. Certainly the children that we're taking care of are in environments where from day one they're exposed to the things that I mentioned, cockroaches and rodents and cigarette smoke in many cases as well.
Dr. Stephen Nicholas, thanks very much for joining us.
Hey, thank you.
Dr. Stephen Nicholas of the Columbia University School of Public Health and the Harlem Hospital Center.
The ancient Eastern art of meditation is about to receive a modern-day boost from a soon-to-be-published study in the journal Psychosomatic Medicine. The study looked at the effects of meditation on the brain, and it's one of only a few scientific examinations in this area. Judy Foreman is our regular medical columnist. She's here to walk us through the latest on meditation. Hi, Judy.
Hi, how are you?
Well, I'm fine. For those of us, though, who, I mean, I have to confess, meditation for me is a place to nap.
Me too.
I haven't quite gotten the hang of it. But what exactly is it? I mean, how do you know you're really meditating?
Well, that's a really good question. And we may not want to go too far there because there's about 1,000 different kinds of meditation. But it's essentially a way of quieting the mind through what they say moment-to-moment non-judgmental awareness, being very mindful. And as a practical thing, it can mean reciting a word or a number over and over to yourself or just being aware of your breath, but your mind sort of quiets down.
Mm. Well, what does the study of the brain and meditation tell us?
This is really one of the most interesting studies I've ever stumbled across. It's by a guy named Richard Davidson at the University of Wisconsin. And they took a bunch of really stressed out people from a high-tech company and gave half of them meditation with lessons for 8 weeks, and they compared them to a group who also wanted to be in the meditation group but got put in the control group. And by the end, it looked as though the people who had learned meditation were able to shift the kind of focal center of the way their brains work from the right, which tends to be more emotional and distressed, to the left. We're talking in the frontal cortex. This is very interesting. They also had a bigger immune response to the flu shot, and generally reported that they were much calmer and happier.
And they were able to measure this happiness in their left frontal cortex by
EEGs, electroencephalographs, which are just, electrodes that they put on your head. And they could see the shift going from the right frontal cortex, which tends to be the area of center for people who are depressed and anxious, to the left, which tends to be the center for happy, calm people.
And they measured before and after so they could tell that.
Yes, exactly.
And what's this idea of being able to respond more to flu shots? Is that with the immune system?
Yes. There seem to be more and more links being discovered between your immune state and your sort of emotional state. And this is yet more proof that at least in a transient way, you may be able to get a positive effect on the immune system by being calmer.
What about longtime practitioners? Have they weighed in on this study?
Yeah, it's really interesting. There was a big conference a couple of years ago in Dharamsala, India, at which the Dalai Lama came and a bunch of these really eminent Western neuroscientists. And they were trying to figure out what changes that meditators report subjectively can be actually documented objectively by Western neuroscience. And actually, some of the monks actually went to the labs of this guy in Wisconsin and in California, and they actually were able to show by various tests that they really were in a different state when they were meditating. Mm. One monk did not show a startle response at all, which is remarkable because that's a very basic biological reflex. It's a calm but very alert state, and there really are differences between the meditators and non-meditators.
Well, Judy, thank you.
You're very welcome.
Judy Foreman is Here and Now as medical columnist. For more, visit our website, here-now.org.
Tomorrow on Here and Now,
Wednesday is the deadline for the new Palestinian Authority prime minister to announce a cabinet, but will infighting in the PLO be a roadblock on the roadmap to peace?
And the story of an American woman who started the Hemingway Book Club in post-war Kosovo. That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, proudly supporting public radio and serving the community, on the web at MathWorks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, former New York City Mayor Ed Koch says it may be necessary to cut police jobs and shut down fire stations to close the city's budget gap, but he won't be buying one of the vintage Yankee Stadium seats that's for sale.
I wasn't a fan before. I'm certainly not going to buy a seat.
Also, we remember one of the most unique voices in jazz, Nina Simone.
And hear from one of today's most renowned jazz bassists, Christian McBride.
These stories coming up Here and Now.
I'm Dave Faniff. The retired U.S. general in charge of rebuilding Iraq met with Kurdish leaders in northern Iraq today. Jay Garner praised the support the Kurds gave the U.S. in pushing out Saddam Hussein. Garner met with a delegation from the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan and spoke to university students.
You are the youth of Iraq. You are going to lead Iraq. You will govern new Iraq. You will raise your children in new Iraq. And you will give birth to a new Iraq.
Despite international tension over the desire for independence, many believe Kurdish cooperation is key to peaceful development of northern Iraq. The UN chief weapons inspector tells the BBC that the U.S. and Britain used forged documents to prove Iraq had weapons that were prohibited. Hans Blix says he finds it very, very disturbing that U.S. intelligence failed to identify some documents suggesting Iraq tried to buy uranium were faked. Thousands of Shiite pilgrims have descended on the Iraqi holy city of Karbala. They're waving black and green flags, chanting and beating their chests, and carrying photographs of famous clerics during a two-day pilgrimage to Iraq's holy cities. The ritual had been banned for decades under Saddam Hussein. Federal officials say a white powder found at a Washington State mail facility may contain the plague or botulism toxin. Homeland Security Department is warning that preliminary tests of the powder could be false because they were done with a handheld device that can be unreliable. An Army National Guard unit is conducting more accurate tests on the powder, which was found in two envelopes early this morning. The worldwide death toll from SARS now tops 230 people. This after officials in Asia announced 17 additional deaths from severe acute respiratory syndrome today. Schools in Hong Kong reopened today after being closed for 3 weeks because of the outbreak, and the students wore surgical masks. Meantime, Canadian authorities say hundreds of people in Toronto may have been exposed to SARS by two hospital workers who had symptoms of the illness but refused to stay home from work. As he prepares for prostate surgery, Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan is getting praise from President Bush. Bush says Greenspan should get another term as Fed chief when his current term runs out in June. White House expressed satisfaction with Greenspan. On Wall Street today, the Dow is up 34 points at 8363. The NASDAQ is up 10 points at 1434. It's 33 minutes past the hour.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
The city that symbolizes the United States to the world, New York City, is facing its worst fiscal crisis since the dark days of the 1970s, when the Big Apple nearly went bankrupt and garbage piled up in the streets. Mayor Michael Bloomberg is proposing what he's calling a possible doomsday budget for next year, under which thousands of city workers and police officers would lose their jobs. Subway and fire stations close. City pools and some zoos close, too. The city is so desperate it's going to sell off some vintage Yankee Stadium seats for $1,000 each. Joining us on the line right now, we're happy to say, is Ed Koch, who was mayor of New York from 1978 to 1989 and is now a commentator for Bloomberg Television and host of a show on Bloomberg Radio, both of which are owned by the current mayor. Mayor Koch, welcome.
Thank you.
Mayor Koch, so how's Mayor Bloomberg doing?
Well, I think he's doing a fine job, frankly. He has to do very tough things, and he's doing it all on the merits. And he's doing it knowing that every time he cuts a service, his favorable rating goes down, but there is no alternative.
New York is a very complex city. How did New York get to a $3.4 billion or more shortfall in their budget? Is there a simple explanation?
Well, you could ask that proportionately of every other city and state in the country. We're all facing that problem. For example, a California state's deficit is $37 billion. New York state's deficit is $11 billion. Now, the explanation for New York City is, one, you have the national downturn in the economy. Two, you had the special impact of 9/11, which has reduced a number of tax collection estimates over the years. And you have the Giuliani administration leaving an unbalanced budget.
What's all this doing to the psyche of New Yorkers, who, after all, have been through a lot since 9/11?
Well, we're very resilient, and we know that people around the country have these same problems. But the fact is that while the deficit issue was more horrendous when I came in 1978 from a technical basis, because we had then a $6 billion short-term debt that we had to pay, and no one knew where to get the money to pay that. Nevertheless, it's more difficult today than it was when I came in to office. And the reason is that the sense of working together and understanding that the suffering is necessary for a relatively brief period of time, that sense is not here. And so the mayor is castigated by everybody whenever he wants to take any action, for example, closing 8 firehouses, which will not in any way, as far as I can see, reduce safety. But nevertheless, people are yelling and screaming. And I believe that the sense of working with the mayor, which existed when I was mayor, doesn't exist today, and that makes his job harder.
So, Mayor Koch, to finish up, you've got a rare tactile feel for New York City and New York State politics.
Yeah.
What do you think is going to happen? Are you just going to have to ultimately make some compromises and wait out the economy? What happens? Does New York go to the doomsday scenario? What happens?
There will be a reduction in services. There will be an increase in taxes. And it will go on for probably up to 3 years. And then we will come back into a capitalist economy, which we have, and I think is the best economy in the world, is cyclical. And we now are in the longest period of the down cycle that has been experienced by any city in the country in the modern era. But it's almost over. It's clear. We're no longer in a recession. There is an increase in the gross national product. And I believe that we will soon see a change in the stock market. And that is a major source of income for New York City. So things will get better. We are very resilient. I'm very confident about the future.
You going to buy a Yankee seat?
I wasn't a fan before. I'm certainly not going to buy a seat.
Hopeful notes. Faith in a great city's future from Ed Koch. Thanks so much for joining us, Mayor
Koch. Thank you. Bye.
Bye. Ed Koch was mayor of New York from 1978 to 1989.
The upcoming movie, The Dancer Upstairs, opens with several Latin American revolutionaries making their escape into the mountains. A cassette tape plays in their pickup truck of a woman talking and talking to some audience. Finally, one of the revolutionaries has had it. "Why doesn't she sing?" she says. "She's getting ready to sing," another replies. Nina Simone fans will smile at that moment. Nina Simone sometimes took a while to sing, but when she did, it was worth the wait.
Here comes the sun, little darling. Here comes the sun. I say it's all right.
raised in North Carolina and Philadelphia, trained at Juilliard, Nina Simone was known as much for her outspoken social activism as for her throaty voice and classical piano playing. She was an expat living in France because, she said, of American racism. A few of her own songs, including Young, Gifted, and Black, are anthems.
We must begin to tell our young. Is the quest that's just begun. When you feel in real love, yeah, there's a great truth that you should know. When you're young, gifted, and right, your soul's intact.
When she sang the songs of others, the originals sometimes paled. Nina Simone was one of a kind. She died yesterday in her home in France at the age of 70.
Don't let them handle me and drive me mad. If you can keep me, I want to stay here with you forever. And I'll be so glad.
You're listening to Here and Now.
Someday I know he's coming back to call on me. He's going to have...
A new ordinance in the city of Greensboro, North Carolina, requires panhandlers to get licenses to beg. The ordinance also outlaws certain behavior, like approaching people on city buses or coming within 3 feet of someone who hasn't indicated whether he or she wants to donate money. Panhandlers who don't follow these rules are subject to a $50 fine. Well, joining us on the line is Mark Binker, reporter for the Greensboro News and Record. And Mark, tell us, what's the purpose of this ordinance?
From the city council's point of view and the city's point of view, they basically wanted a way to control certain behaviors. There really isn't a huge problem with panhandlers being on every city corner or city sidewalk, but there are a few well-known places around the city that people were concerned about, and the city council wanted to give police a way to control these folks.
Well, we hear that some of the people are saying that the purpose is also to protect panhandlers so they're not out on medians and out on highways, but was there, as we read, an aggressive move by some businesses to get this passed?
There was a request from the business community. One of the larger landowners in town is the Quarry Corporation, and they had asked the city manager to request this ordinance. There was also some requests from smaller businesses who thought that they might be losing some foot traffic from people who were crossing the street to avoid a panhandler. Yeah. The city attorney's office wrote the ordinance, basically, and city council signed off on it with a minimum of discussion. There wasn't a whole lot of opposition to it.
But you're saying that Greensboro isn't exactly run amok with panhandlers. It's not a big problem.
No, it's not a huge problem, although you will, if you're coming off one of the major interstates through here is I-40, and there are a couple of exits off of I-40 where, especially on the weekends, you'll have some folks who are out in middle of traffic and asking for spare change, and that was particularly felt to be a problem, both a safety issue for the people doing it and also maybe a little bit of an issue for people who were coming into town for the first time, maybe didn't know where they were, and all of a sudden they were approached by somebody asking for spare change.
Yeah, we hear that actually some of the advocates for the homeless are happy with the ordinance because they feel that just a few of these panhandlers give the larger community of homeless a bad name.
That's what they said when word of the ordinance first started circulating around the city. What they want is for people who are truly having problems to come and ask for help from some of these nonprofit services and some of these city services. They also feel that when it comes time for some nonprofits to raise money, they don't want the image of the homeless being that fellow at the interstate exit in donors' mind. They want a more human picture in people's mind, yeah, when they give.
Well, the licenses are free, and they don't apply to groups like the Girl Scouts and other groups that collect funds. But I'm wondering, does it really make sense to the people in Greensboro to fine a panhandler $50 for not being licensed? I just have this image of illegal panhandlers panhandling to make their fines for illegally panhandling.
it does on its surface maybe sound a bit odd. The logic that was used in constructing the ordinance was that panhandling is really a form of commerce. One of the city attorneys who I talked to early on in the process said, look, there's this guy who I see out there every Saturday. His sign's laminated. He's wearing a new set of Nike shoes. This is somebody who's obviously engaging in commerce and keeping himself very well through this activity. So the idea is to regulate it as you would regulate a business.
One last question, Mark. How do you get these things? Just go down to City Hall as you would get any license? Or?
Yeah, you go into City Hall, and the licenses are actually administered by the tax department. Last time I checked, nobody had come in and asked for one yet, but it's been a couple days.
Mark, thank you.
Okay.
Mark Binker, reporter for the Greensboro News and Record. He spoke to us from Raleigh, North Carolina.
It's Here and Now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Judging by his new CD, there's not a lot of music Christian McBride doesn't hear in his head. From funk to acoustic, electric to mainstream, fusion to swing and bop, and it's all adventurous, rockingly rhythmic, and always dense with the impeccable musicianship of a young master of the bass. That's a piece of Boogie Woogie Waltz from Christian McBride's new CD, Vertical Vision. And Christian joins me now in the studio. Christian, it's a pleasure.
Pleasure to be here, Bill.
First, Christian, Boogie Woogie Waltz, tell me about the track and the bass.
Well, that's an old song that Weather Report used to do for a very long time before Birdland became their big hit. And I've always felt that one of the reasons why a group like Weather Report or some other great bands, namely a lot of Miles Davis' bands, were so great was because there were five equal leaders. And Boogie Woogie Waltz really struck me as one of the first songs where everybody stands out, but nobody stands out.
Where'd you get all this wisdom for such a young guy? You're in your early 30s.
I've been spending my time hanging around the legends. You know, I figure that's the only way to do it if I'm going to be a good musician.
You've also been developing your musicianship and your musical sound for quite a long time now, and anyone who hears this album is going to be intrigued by how you open it, because you open it with something called Circa 1990. Now, I don't know why it's called Circa 1990, because it sounds like it could have been from the 30s.
Right.
It's kind of like a scratchy 78.
Yeah.
And then that kind of segues into something called Technicolor Nightmare, which is very, very up to the minute. Let's hear a bit of that transition.
No. Put the other record on.
Christian, what's going on at the top of this album?
That was kind of a little inside joke. When I moved to New York City and became a part of the jazz scene, it was the beginning of what was known as the Young Lions era. The jazz writers and the jazz critics put this stamp on any musician at the time who was under the age of 25 and who had any association whatsoever with Wynton Marsalis. And the truth of the matter is, Wynton Marsalis is very important to me. He was one of the first musicians I met on a national, on international scale, who really seemed to take a real sincere interest in my career. And I will forever be grateful to Wynton Marsalis, and I love everything he does. I respect him as a musician and as a person. But at the same time, I was also very intrigued as to why all of the critics, just because we had some association with him, thought that we were going to follow in his footsteps the exact same way. That's very dangerous to do when you talk about somebody who's only 17 years old, you know.
That's right.
Sooner or later, you're going to grow as humans. Of course, you're going to grow as musicians. So circa 1990 was my little joke, as if to say, this is how the critics thought we sounded in 1990.
You're a bass player. Mm-hmm. Those roots run deep in the family, don't they?
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
Well, my dad's a bass player as well as my great uncle. When I was a little boy, my father was playing mostly rhythm and blues and soul music. He was on the road with people like the Delphonics and Billy Paul and Major Harris. And my great uncle, he was playing with people like, he actually still plays with Sun Ra's Orchestra, Con Jamal, Byard Lancaster, a lot of people who are associated with the more or less avant-garde scene.
And yet you have some classical roots, too. I mean, you went to Juilliard for a while.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. How much does that inform your music?
Well, when I first started taking acoustic bass lessons, you know, I had to study formally. I had to play in the orchestra. There's really not a whole lot of repertoire for classical bass. I mean, you're talking about piano and violin. You have, you know, hundreds, thousands of pieces, but not a whole lot for bass. So I was always fortunate to have a lot of great teachers who turned me on to the more exciting realm of classical bass.
Now listening to this album is really fascinating, because if you come to it for driving, brilliant bass, it's there. But it's also, there's a lot of different colors on this album. One of the most striking to me was a song called Lejos de Usted, Far From You.
Yeah.
Let's listen to a bit of that.
Aunque estés lejos de mí, nunca te olvidaré, porque todo lo que me ofreciste fue muy profundo para mí. Y si algún día nos vemos por ahí, abrázame de nuevo para revivir lo que fue lo más hermoso para mí. Y ojalá que tú también te recuerdas de mí.
We actually did the entire track, and sitting there at the booth and I'm talking to my saxophonist, Ron Blake, and I said, man, this, there could be one thing that could really make this song special, but I'm not sure what it is. So we're just sitting there listening to it over and over and over again. I said, I know, it needs a really gorgeous Spanish-speaking voice on there. And Ron said, yeah, well, great, where are you going to find that on such short notice?
Yeah.
And as it turns out, the receptionist at the recording studio was from the Dominican Republic. So I said, Liz, can I borrow you for a minute?
Man.
So she came in the studio. And
beautiful voice she had.
Yeah. And I said, listen, make up something, you know. And that's all hers.
Mi amor, cuánto pienso en ti. Tus ojos, tus labios, y tu ternura.
Christian, where do you want to go next? I mean, what is your dream for what you do with your music? Can you put it in words, or do you just keep moving through the years and see where you go?
Yeah, I kind of like to go on the fly, you know, kind of go where my heart takes me at the moment. I actually feel like I now have the best working band I've ever had, with Jeffrey Keyser and Ron Blake and Terrion Gully. And the reason why is because this is the first group of musicians I've ever had who like experimenting with a lot of different colors, and it really helps your musical journey when you have guys on board who are that open.
Musical journey. Let's go out on a number then. Why don't you pick a song?
How about the Ballad of Little Girl Dancer?
That's a beauty. Christian McBride, we wish you all the best. Thanks a lot for coming in.
My pleasure being here.
Jazz bassist Christian McBride. His new CD is called Vertical Vision. For information on the CD and to check out if he and his band are coming to a city near you, check out our website, here-now.org.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
Our production team includes Andrea Shea, Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Emiko Tomagawa, Alan Cockle, Karen Miller-Medson, and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna, and our editor is Mitch Wortley. Special thanks to Jordana Gustafson.
Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Thomas Terry. Our web producer is Zach Christo. And our interns are Lindsay Crudell, Marisa Francini, and Meheleka Samdani.
The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Stay tuned to your public radio station for the latest news.
And join us again. Here and Now. For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. Information on the web at mathworks.com.